Welcome to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. This time, we're focused on financial reporting for accounting changes and error corrections. KPMG recently hosted an hour-long webcast on this topic, and today, we will address some of the frequently asked questions from that session. KPMG also published a new handbook on accounting changes and error corrections, which provides more detailed guidance on this topic and is a great reference for companies. Both the replay of the webcast and the handbook can be accessed on the website at frv.kpmg.us/podcasts. Now, let's listen to KPMG professionals discuss key points and considerations on these complicated areas.
Welcome to this episode of the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. I'm Karen Silverman, a partner at KPMG, and this episode we're focusing on accounting changes and error corrections. Today, I'm visiting with a partner I work with in the firm's Department of Professional Practice, Tim Phelps. Tim is also one of the presenters from the webcast and a principal author of the new handbook. Tim, are you ready to have a chat with me about accounting changes and error corrections?
Karen, welcome to the podcast and thank you. I'm ready and looking forward to this chat with you.
Great. I know that accounting changes and error corrections can be complicated issues for many companies. So before we dive into the FAQs from the webcast, can you give us a brief summary of some of the key considerations when companies have an accounting change?
Karen, there are three types of accounting changes contemplated in ASC 250. Changes in accounting principle, whether as a result of a new ASU or a voluntary change made by a preparer, changes in accounting estimates, and changes in reporting entity. Understanding the type of accounting change you as a preparer are faced with is obviously important, as the type of a change will determine the transition requirements for the accounting change and how to apply the change, meaning retrospectively, in the current period, or prospectively. Lastly, while Topic 250 doesn't provide preparers with specific guidance on changes in classification and presentation in the financial statements or in the notes to the financial statements that do not rise to the level of either a change in accounting principle and are not errors, we believe that similar to a change in accounting principle, an entity should apply the change retrospectively.
Thanks, Tim. I think that's a great summary to get us all started off on the same page. Several of the follow-up questions we received from the webcast were related to how a company should think about the distinction between a change in accounting principle and a change in accounting estimate. Are there situations where the method used to make an estimate and the principle are inseparable?
Being able to distinguish between a change in an accounting principle and a change in accounting estimate is sometimes very complex and difficult. The typical example used when discussing this scenario is a change in the method of depreciation of a long-lived asset, such as property, plant, and equipment. In certain cases, such as a change in the method of depreciation, a change in accounting estimate is affected or accomplished by the change in accounting principle, the method. The new depreciation method or accounting principle is adopted in recognition that there has been a change in the estimated future benefits that are inherent in that long-lived asset, the pattern of consumption of its benefits, or the information available to the entity about those benefits. The effect of the change in accounting principle or the method of applying it may be inseparable from the effect of the change in accounting estimate. It's important to note that because the change in estimate is affected or accomplished by a change in accounting principle, a preferability assessment is required to support the change. It's important to talk to your independent accountants and auditors when a change in accounting principle appears to be inseparable between the accounting principle and the accounting estimate. The earlier the communication, the better.
Thanks, Tim. I think that's good feedback for this topic as a whole. Involving your accountants and auditors early in the process can be extremely helpful in this scenario. Can you tell us more about the concept of preferability, including what we are seeing in practice?
Karen, as I stated in the recent webcast, Topic 250 applies to all entities, meaning both public and private entities, and Topic 250 covers both financial statements and historical summaries of information, such as selected financial data or any information derived from the financial statements. Probably the most noticeable difference is that public entities are required to include a preferability letter from its independent accountants in the respective SEC filing, such as a Form 10-Q or a Form 10-K, in the period in which the voluntary change in accounting principle occurs. This requirement does not exist for private entities, which makes understanding the trends for private entities somewhat by observation rather than by simply searching the Edgar database for public entities. Nonetheless, the consideration by preparers and independent accountants and auditors of voluntary changes in accounting principle are somewhat frequent. But reaching the conclusion that a proposed voluntary change in accounting principle is preferable happens less frequently than the actual desire to change. A presumption exists that an accounting principle, once adopted, should not be changed in accounting for events and transactions of a similar type. The consistent use of the same accounting principle from one accounting period to another enhances the use of financial statements for users by facilitating analysis and understanding of comparative accounting data. Preferability remains a very high hurdle for a voluntary change in accounting principle.
So this is not something we see frequently in practice.
No, it's somewhat infrequent that we see successful voluntary changes in accounting principle in general.
Okay. In the webcast, there was some discussion about the concept of impracticability. We received several questions on this topic that we weren't able to cover in the webcast. Can you discuss that concept more and maybe give some examples of where a company might apply that concept?
Well, the concept of impracticability exists in the standards and guidance. It is in the rarest of situations that the preparer and the independent accountant and auditor would conclude that it's impractical to apply the effects of an accounting change retrospectively. Guidance that is included in ASC 250 tries to highlight just how high of a hurdle impracticability is by requiring that a preparer must meet any of the following conditions to conclude it is impracticable. After making every reasonable effort to do so, the entity is unable to apply the requirement. Retrospective application requires assumptions about management's intent in a prior period that cannot be independently substantiated. Retrospective application requires significant estimates of amounts, and it's impossible to distinguish objectively information about those estimates. Any consultation with your independent accountant and auditor should occur very, very early if a preparer believes that it will conclude that it's impracticable to apply the effects of a change in accounting principle retrospectively. Lastly, an important reminder for everyone, as I also said on the webcast, financial statements filed with the SEC must comply with U.S. GAAP applicable to public entities. The SEC will not accept impracticability for not applying U.S. GAAP to public entities to the earliest period presented.
Thanks again, Tim. So we've covered a scenario when a company has changes to their accounting principles. Can you talk to us about what happens when a company discovers that an error has been made in their financial statements?
Well, I think it's important to understand what is meant by an error. An error may relate to a difference between an amount, classification, presentation, or disclosure of a reported financial statement item and the amount, classification, presentation, or disclosure that should be reported in conformity with GAAP. Therefore, a misstatement may occur in an amount such as a monetary misstatement, presentation such that the presentation of an item is incorrect, classification, such that an item is incorrectly classified, or disclosure, such as an omitted or incomplete and or inaccurate disclosure. In considering how errors should be corrected in the financial statements, the starting point is to determine whether the prior period financial statements are materially misstated. Is the error material to prior period financial statements? If yes, then restate the prior period financial statements. Is the error material to current period financial statements? If yes, then adjust prior period financial statements. If not, then correct in the current period financial statements.
You know, I often hear folks refer to the concept of a big R and a little R. Can you give us a bit more context on what that means and the implications for a company's financial statements?
Karen, excellent question. As those are more common terms you hear preparers using rather than restatement and immaterial correction of an error. Simplistically, if an error is material to the prior period and current period financial statements, and the prior period financial statements are restated, that is what is commonly referred to as a big R. If an error is not material to the prior period and current period financial statements, and the correction of the error occurs in the current period financial statements, including any comparative periods that are presented, that is what is referred to as a little R.
Thanks, Tim. It sounds like that determination has a huge impact on the ultimate resolution of the error. Can you walk us through the factors a company would consider when making that determination? And would those factors be different for an error on the face of the financial statements as opposed to the footnotes?
To determine whether an error is material, a preparer will need to perform both a qualitative and quantitative assessment. The assessment is not an either-or determination. Also, remember what we discussed previously as to what constitutes an error. An error can be in an amount, classification, presentation, or a disclosure that is not in conformity with GAAP. Whether on the face of the financial statements or in the notes of the financial statements, an error is an error that is required to be evaluated by the preparer. Because of the interaction of quantitative and qualitative considerations and materiality judgments, by evaluating these factors together, a preparer may determine that an error is material, even if it is not quantitatively large, or immaterial, even if it is quantitatively large. A preparer evaluates errors individually and in the aggregate in relation to specific financial statement captions and disclosures, and the financial statements as a whole, and not just the current period, but also the effect on prior periods and future periods. In general, there are three methods used to quantify and evaluate the effect of uncorrected errors on the financial statements: the Iron Curtain method, the rollover method, and the dual method, which is required for all SEC registrants. When performing the quantitative and qualitative assessments, all relevant circumstances are considered, including, most importantly, the factual context in which the user of the financial statements would view the financial statement item. Errors may be material, even if it's not quantitatively large, such as an illegal payment of an otherwise immaterial amount, a small error that was made intentionally for fraudulent purposes, a misclassification between balance sheet financial statement captions that affects a key ratio, a small error that affects a disclosure that has a history of causing volatility in the price of an entity's security, such as EPS, or lastly, an error in revenue that is not quantitatively material may be material if it changes the trends in revenues from decreasing to increasing, and that trend is important to the financial statement users.
Thanks, Tim. We received several questions on that topic in the webcast, so that clarification should be helpful. Have we seen any specific trends related to restatements recently?
Luckily, restatements, or big Rs, continue on the downward trend. The analysis, however, as to whether identified errors constitute a material error occurs quite frequently between preparers and independent accountants and auditors, with the vast majority being considered immaterial corrections of an error or little Rs. This is not to diminish the level of effort that goes into immaterial correction of an error. The process that preparers undertake when an error is discovered is largely identical up until the point where the conclusion is really reached related to the severity of the error, as material or immaterial. At this point, the preparer would begin the process of restating the prior period financial statements or correcting the immaterial error in the current period financial statements as an out-of-period correction of an error.
In these situations, would it also be important for companies to evaluate the implications on internal control over financial reporting?
For every error that is discovered, there should be an evaluation of internal controls for that error, individually and in the aggregate. It's important that preparers perform an appropriate root cause analysis to fully understand why the error was not prevented or detected by the preparer's system of internal controls. Was it a design flaw in the control, or was the control appropriately designed? However, the control operator did not perform the control as designed, so there is an operating effectiveness failure. The only way that the appropriate remediation occurs is to properly identify the root cause.
Thanks, Tim. Having been involved in several root cause analyses myself, I know that the evaluation can also be challenging. Overall, it sounds like accounting changes and error corrections can have meaningful impacts on financial reporting for companies. So the additional guidance published in the handbook should be really helpful to provide more detail. Tim, you've given our listeners a deeper understanding of some of the financial reporting considerations around accounting changes and error corrections, and answered some of the FAQs from the webcast. Thanks for taking some time to have a chat with me.
No problem, Karen. It's been my distinct pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast with information related to the accounting changes and error corrections on Topic 250. For additional reference, please visit the website at frv.kpmg.us/podcasts for a new handbook KPMG published that provides guidance on accounting changes and error corrections.